Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out. It's a pleasure to be here. So this program was initially done at the law school, just among a small group, and the dean enjoyed it so much that Lisa Broom took her own initiative to start the ball rolling to bring this topic, Think Fast, to the broader university community, and we thank her very much for that. It's sort of a combination between the School of Law, Business, and Economics, so we're going to hear all kinds of perspectives this evening on what exactly is going on. We do have a limited, tight schedule, and we've got a lot of very smart people who are used to talking for at least 55 minutes. So I have my handy stopwatch here. If you see me flailing from the audience, it probably means your time is up. Also, again, the reminder, you can put your questions on a note card, and we will be taking as many of those questions as possible, and the goal with the stopwatch is to get everyone's question in. So, without further ado, as was said once before, also just wanted to mention that there is a handout if everyone wants to have a bio in front of them as people talk. It is available just outside, and you should have received one when you came in. So let's get to our first speaker now to start this. We'll have Jennifer Conrad speak first. And Jennifer is the Dalton McMichael Distinguished Professor of Finance at Kenan Flagler Business School. And she's going to be also sharing the stage with Chris Lundblad, the Edward M. O'Haron Distinguished Scholar and Associate Professor of Finance. And again, more on their bios in your handout.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for coming. So it's odd to start a talk to a very general audience with a picture like this, but this is very much the point, actually, which is complexity. And this is sort of basically a primer on what we're dealing with right now from the standpoint of the securitization side of all of this. And I just want to give you this to give you a flavor of the challenges that we're facing and what's sort of a little bit different now from what we've seen in the past. So one piece of the puzzle, you know, if we all sort of went and got mortgages historically, you'd go down to the corner bank, you'd get your mortgage and pay it back, and presumably the bank may very well sit on that mortgage for the entire term of the loan. Those days are long, long gone. And instead, what happens is those mortgages get packaged into pools and sold off to other investors in pieces. And much of what we saw late was an explosion of that kind of facilitation in the subprime space. So who's a subprime guy? Well, that's somebody, if you look here in these blocks, that sort of maybe scored poorly on the credit dimension and maybe had a bad loan-to-value ratio on the loan so that they had sort of a low down payment. And what would happen then is we would collect all of those various loans that satisfied that classification together, consolidate them, pool them, and the way that this was done was to put them into tranches, which were delineated basically by credit quality. And what would happen then is invariably some of these subprime loans would default, and the losses there associated with that default would first accrue to those people that were lowest in this credit spectrum, those furthest down this ladder. And those indeed were the ones that we're hearing about today as being toxic. Those shares are the ones that were the first hit in the instance of this kind of default. And then if we sort of move up the credit quality, the people higher along are only going to get hurt if there's a huge amount of defaults over here on the top level. So this already is sort of complex. It's securitization. We've seen it for some time. But here it has an additional complexity in that it's related to some subprime stuff, which I'll talk about more in a moment. And additionally, a lot of these things, as were many, many others, they were spun off into subsequent pools and collected with pieces from other parts of the financial space. And that's where you're seeing CDOs and CDO squared and all of the various acronyms that have become four-letter words today, effectively. And so the punchline here is complexity. You may have end investors, which are very, very far removed from the original instruments that we're sort of talking about. Additionally, you may also not really understand the full exposures of the counterparties in this space, and all of that makes things a bit complicated. Now, what did this do? Well, it did, on the one side, increase the capital base for mortgages in a large degree, and we saw a tremendous run-up in housing prices as a result of that. One, this is from Robert Shiller, the now famous economist, webpage, run-up in housing prices that's basically unprecedented in our modern history. And this is, again, is partially fueled by the increase in the credit, increase in the capital base, and it's also important in terms of its feeding back onto that, which I'll mention in just a moment. So this is incredibly important, and what you see in that little dip down has accelerated in more recent months, and now we see housing prices being off 20 to 30% in certain parts of the country. So how big was this market, subprime, this particular component? Well, what I have here is basically a table that describes how much of this kind of thing was going on. And if you look at overall mortgage origination in this country, we're talking about $2-3 trillion over here. That's you know, sort of goes around a bit through time. But what you see is a dramatic increase in the next couple of columns for the role for subprime in that space. So we're talking about subprime making something like 8% of mortgage origination all the way up till about a fifth. Once this game was kind of reaching the end in 2007 is when everything really started to slow down. So not only is subprime a bigger part of the game, but it is also largely being securitized by the end of all this. So the last two columns tell you how much of that subprime stuff was indeed securitized. And by the end, about 80% was securitized. So these kinds of instruments are really floating around out there big time. And what's quite different here for subprime is that many of these loans were constructed in the following way. They were given a very brief teaser rate, where you'd have a low interest rate for a few years, and then that would eventually balloon into a much larger number. And the only way that that could fly for a subprime borrower that's not going to be able to facilitate that larger interest rate at the end of the day is if they can refinance at some later date. And the only way that they can refinance at some later date is if the house that they've purchased has gone up in value. So if the house goes up in value, what can they do? Well, they can capture that equity, refinance, effectively use that as a down payment, and now they may no longer be technically subprime. The without which there is nothing there is the house price going up. Well, housing prices slowed, eventually started to recede, and now we saw this explosion in delinquencies over here. And that's exactly what we're getting, is this explosion in delinquencies. Foreclosures are starting to amass from all of this. And the problem is the folks that are left with the bag here are the banking sector and other players in the financial industry. And it's indeed this that we're starting to see sort of permeating the entire finance side and eventually even the economy, because folks are, you know, dealing with all of these complex instruments, layers upon layers of stuff that's sort of originating here in this mortgage industry. So now, what do the banks do? Well, I'll turn it over to my colleague, who's going to give you a sense of what it is the banks are struggling with and how we can proceed.
So Chris has described in a little bit of detail the securities that are at the heart of this crisis. He's talked about their complexity, which is a word that I want you to remember, and he's talked about the size of the market. And so we come to the end of 2006, and we're moving into 2007, and a number of banks have a lot of dollars tied up in these assets on their balance sheets, and the asset values that they have on their balance sheets start to decline. And we already see in the data that Chris showed us why these asset values started to decline. The first reason is that the asset that supported everything here at the house values started to run down in value at the end of 2006. Of course, that decline in value accelerated through 2007, is continuing to decline in 2008. And then the payments to these securities started to go down as well. And you can see that in the uptick in the mortgage delinquency rates, again, starting in about 2006. So what would you expect a bank or a number of banks to do when they're looking at these this drop in the asset values on their balance sheets? Well, the first thing they'd have to do is to acknowledge the drop in values. And one of the ways that they can do that is to write down the assets on their balance sheets or potentially sell those assets. And if the hole that is created when they write down those assets or when they sell them is sufficiently large to maintain their capital ratios, they might also have to raise equity. Now, those two transactions, selling the assets and raising the equities, require a functioning market. And the market did function. I mean, as late as July of 2008, Merrill Lynch was able to sell some of these assets off their balance sheet, maybe not at a price that they would have wanted, at about 22 cents on the dollar, but they were able to do it, and they were able to raise equity on that same day. But asset values continued to decline, and then something else started to happen, and that is that markets started to fail. And there are some conditions under which markets can fail. And I wanted to talk about those conditions, and I wanted to talk about them in the context in which the paper that originally talked about this problem did so. I'm going to use the example. Well, the paper's called The Market for Lemons, and it starts out something like this. So you want to buy a used car, right? And you go down to the used car market. I'm going to put that in air quotes. And you're looking at all these used cars, and they just look great. They've been detailed. Their exteriors are immaculate. But, of course, you know that what really matters with a used car is what's under the hood. And you also know a couple of other things, and that is that there are big differences in quality in what's under the hood with used cars. And you know that you have, at best, an imperfect ability to assess those differences in quality. And so let's say, for the purposes of my example, that used cars can vary in value because of those differences in quality from $0 to $10,000. And let's work through the process that you would go through in trying to come up with a bid for a particular used car. One thing that you might say, think of it as round one, is that if I pick a random car off this used car market, that if I bid the average value, say $5,000 in this example, that on average I won't be taken advantage of too badly. I might get a car, again randomly, that's worth a little less than $5,000, but I might get a good car. And so on average, I'll be okay. Well, for every transaction, remember, there has to be not just a willing buyer, but a willing seller. And so think of this as round two. You've thought about putting in a bid of $5,000, and now the second problem raises its head. And one of the things you might worry about in the used car market in particular is that the sellers of the car might look at your bid of $5,000 and they might know more about the value of their car than you do. They have, after all, been driving it around for the last few years. And so in this scenario, the person who thinks that their car is worth $8,000 is not going to come to the market for you with your bid of $5,000. And so now what's happened, bad cars have driven good cars out of the market. You say to yourself, I can take care of that. I can drop the bid for a used car. So you think about dropping it to $2,500. Still, the seller is likely to know more about the value of the car than you do, and they're going to pull now cars that are worth $3,500 off the market. And so now bad cars have driven not so good cars out of the market. And in the end, if these problems, if these conditions are met, the market can fail. What are the two conditions I talked about? Difference in quality across the assets. Is that condition met in the market for these securities that Chris talked about? Well, think about that first picture that he put up that is quite scary to look at. Those assets are so complex that they have huge differences in quality across them. They have different mortgage originators, they have different vintages, they have different geographies in the mortgage that are backing those securities. So I think we can check off that first condition. And what about the second condition? The seller had to know more than the potential buyer of these assets. Well, these banks had been driving these mortgage-backed securities around for a while, potentially. In fact, in a lot of cases, they built the pricing models that enabled them to have these issued in the first place. So the second condition also became a concern. And in those conditions, if there's not enough trust in the marketplace, the market's going to fail. And so eventually banks aren't going to be able to either sell the assets or to raise equity. And when you have a lack of trust, which is what this is, then banks, it turns out, are peculiarly sensitive to a lack of trust. What do banks do? When we walk into a bank and we hand it some money and we open up a demand deposit, what the bank does is it offers us a commitment that we'll store your money for you and we'll give it back whenever you want. So that promise from the bank to us is very, very liquid, right? We can walk in and get our money whenever we want. What does the bank do with the money that they take from us? They take some of that money and they give it out as loans. But the loans that they give out don't have that same liquid feature. They can't go back to the borrower and say, we want our money back now. So there's a mismatch between the liquid liabilities that banks use to fund themselves and the illiquid assets, the loans that they have on their balance sheets. Most of the time, this mismatch in liquidity doesn't bother us as depositors because we're all not going to rush to the bank's door at the same time to get our money back. Unless we're a little worried about the bank's stability, right? In that case, we might think about trying to ask for our money back from the bank, even if we're not worried about the bank's stability, right? Even if we're the rational ones on the block, what we might worry about is the other depositors at the bank. And if they're all going to be worried about the bank's stability, then we might want to get ahead of them in line to ask for our money back. And so in that case, you can have a run on the bank. And anyone who's seen It's a Wonderful Life will remember that quite vividly. even now, of course, deposit insurance has taken the probability of a run on a single bank kind of off the table, not quite. But there's another situation with banks that can also create a similar crisis, and that is other lenders to the bank. And so if other lenders to the bank are worried about the safety of their money, then you can have lenders in this situation who might also create a run, not just on an individual bank, but a run on the banking system. Did we have those conditions in this market? Well, if you take a look at lending rates between banks, and here's an interest rate that you might heard of lately. This is the London Interbank Offer Rate, or LIBOR. You can see that we have spikes, particularly recently, in the rates that banks would charge other banks to lend to them. So it's not necessarily just the depositors that we need to worry about, it's other lenders to the bank. And if these overnight markets don't work, then banks are not going to be able to make those productive loans, and it's going to have effects on the real economy. Okay. And so I think Lisa's up next, and she's going to tell us a little bit more about bank runs.
It was increased by the bailout bill, which was passed October 3rd, to $250,000. That's for banks, savings associations, as well as for those of you who might have your money in the State Employees Credit Union. It has a separate deposit insurance provider, the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund, but it also went up to $250,000. By statute, that's not a permanent increase. It is only to last until December 31st, 2009. Another little-known feature of deposit insurance is that it really can potentially be much more than whatever the stated amount is. So for instance, now that we're at $250,000, that is per account per person. And if, for instance, a husband and a wife hold a joint account, they are insured in that joint account up to $500,000. Each joint account holder gets $250,000 of deposit insurance. Moreover, the husband could have a separate individual account, so it's a different type of account at that same institution, and receive up to $250,000 of deposit insurance coverage on that account. Same for the wife. So in this particular example, if you were fortunate enough to have $1 million, you could, and a husband and wife could have it all fully insured at one bank. They could also, if they had more extra change than the $1 million, go to another bank and start the whole process over again. So that change on October 3rd as part of the rescue bill was intended to boost depositor confidence so that we would not experience this phenomenon of bank runs. For those of you who might have particular questions or concerns, there is an online deposit insurance estimator on the FDIC website where you can plug in your own numbers, make up numbers if you wish, to see how it works. Barely less than 2 weeks after the bailout bill was passed, on October 14th, the Treasury and the boards of the FDIC and the Federal Reserve invoked another provision called the systemic risk provision in a statute that was passed in 1991, the FDIC Improvement Act. And they said, maybe that's not enough, what we did in the bailout bill, and we're going to use the systemic risk provision to further increase deposit insurance by guaranteeing deposits above $250,000 that are held in non-interest-bearing checking accounts. And these would typically be commercial deposits for which banks are not permitted by law to pay interest. And the amount of these accounts could be quite high on various days. If you're getting ready to run your payroll for the month, there would be a lot of money. And that particular account, well in a excess of the FDIC deposit insurance threshold. So again, for a temporary period until December 31, 2009, all of these non-interest-bearing deposits will be fully insured up to the entire amount of the deposit. Our own local institution, Wachovia Bank, was apparently the victim of a bank run the Friday before Citigroup announced its potential acquisition on a Monday. And this was commercial depositors who were fearful of Wachovia's ability to repay their deposits and who did exactly what Jennifer just described and withdrew a lot of money from the bank. If the bank runs out of cash, the bank's then recourse is to borrow more money, which may not be available to it, as Jennifer alluded to, or to liquidate assets, potentially at a fire sale price. So that's what led Wachovia into the arms of the FDIC for a potentially assisted acquisition by Citigroup, which was then subsequently preempted by the Wells Fargo bid. So the only deposits that are not insured at this point in time are interest-bearing deposits that exceed $250,000 in one single deposit account. Second thing that this temporary liquidity guarantee program did was to assure the lenders to banks, the other people that the banks need to get money from, if the bank is issuing senior unsecured debt to a lender on or before June 30th, 2009, this will be fully guaranteed by the U.S. government. So that lender should know the full faith and credit of the United States Treasury is backing my loan to this bank. Whether I'm even though I'm not a depositor, if I'm a lender, I will get repaid. Both of these provisions are presumably funded by the banks themselves, not by taxpayers. So this is not being funded through the bailout bill, but there is a surcharge for deposit insurance that's charged to banks to cover these excess amounts, and also a fee that will be charged to write the guarantee for the debt of the bank. Another thing that was done as part of this systemic risk provision was a partial temporary nationalization of our banks. Banks and bank holding companies may now sell preferred stock in themselves to the United States. There are certain limits on how much they can sell. And the first $250 billion of the $700 billion bailout is committed for this specific use. And Don will talk a little bit more about it. But the actual authority to make the investment is coming from another statute from the 1991 FDIC Improvement Act and its systemic risk provision. I have quotes around voluntary, and the reason is half of this money, $125 billion, was basically foisted upon the nine largest banks and bank holding companies in our country. $25 billion to Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, and $20 to $25 billion to Wells Fargo, presumably after it has acquired Wachovia. The two investment banks, which became bank holding companies before this provision was invoked, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, are also going to be beneficiaries of this preferred stock investment. Now, there is a cost to these banks. They must pay the United States government quarterly dividends of 5% per year for the first 5 years that this preferred stock is outstanding, and then 9% per year thereafter. In addition, as part of this deal, the Treasury will receive warrants to buy common stock in the bank at the market price at the time they make their preferred stock investment in an amount that would equal up to 15% of their preferred stock investment. This is similar to both the guarantees of debt and the government investments in banks, two things that have been done in other countries, including the ones listed above and others that are not listed there. So we've got the FDIC. It is required by law to maintain reserves to cover its deposit insurance obligations that equal 1.15% of all deposits that it is insuring. And right now, it is below the required ratio. It only has 1.01% of insured deposits held as reserves because there have been 13 bank failures already this year. Furthermore, the FDIC estimates that losses from bank failures over the next 5 years, notwithstanding these various provisions to save banks that have been put in place, are likely to exceed $40 billion, and their current reserves are only $45 billion. So they have proposed to raise deposit insurance premiums that the banks pay on January 1 of 2009. Currently, the rates typically range between 5 to 7 cents per $100 of insured deposits, with an average of 6.5 cents. And that will double if this provision goes into effect to a wider range based on the riskiness of the bank's asset portfolio, its loan portfolio, ranging from between 8 and 21 cents per $100 of insured deposits, averaging at 13.5 cents per $100. And I just wanted to conclude with this look at our domestic banking industry. This doesn't include the foreign bank holding companies that are operating here in the United States. And this is as of the end of the first quarter of 08, grouped by asset size. So you can see Citigroup had over $2 trillion in assets, Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase over $1 million. I've underlined J.P. Morgan Chase because they're getting together now with Washington Mutual, which failed, and Wachovia and Wells Fargo are in italics because of their potential merger as well. So we put Wachovia and Wells Fargo together and we get another above $1 trillion bank. Washington Mutual goes away, and look how we fall off to very small number, or much smaller numbers after that, in terms of size of banking institutions. So one thing that we may want to look for in the coming months is what will the banks be doing with this new preferred stock, this new capital that the U.S. government is putting into them? Hopefully, although there is no requirement that I can find in the statutory authority, hopefully they will be making loans with that capital. But another thing that they might also be doing with that capital is using it to further consolidate the banking industry, buying other banking institutions so that we close the gap some between the four largest and the others. So I will conclude my remarks there.
Early 1900s, dealing with agricultural futures, futures contracts and forward contracts and the like. There sprung up around the derivatives market, the futures market, a whole series of regulation dealing solely with agricultural derivatives. Over time, the use of these financial instruments expanded. Again, complexity becomes the word of the day, but expanded from agricultural derivatives, whether it's lumber futures or pork belly futures, to hard assets such as gold and silver and oil futures that certainly have an interrelationship with the financial markets, and then beyond that, financial futures. And that developed even further into what we now refer to as swap transactions, where basically people can hedge or bet or speculate on just about anything in the financial markets or any asset. Just to give an example that would tie into what we're talking about today, if I'm a bank that has some mortgage obligations, mortgages, and given out some loans, or if I'm someone who has purchased some of these CDOs, these securitized debt obligations, I might want to hedge or insure my risk of loss by owning these or having these obligations. So what I might do is enter into a contract with Don or Lisa, where I would pay them a premium, a price, and in exchange, if there were a default and I suffered a loss, they would pay me the loss I would otherwise suffer. So insurance is one way it's described. In fact, that's the way that Alan Greenspan described it today before Congress in terms of what these credit derivative swaps are. They are a way to insure against a risk of loss. It's a market that some people estimate is not only hundreds of billions of dollars, but hundreds of trillions of dollars, because it's not limited to people that have an actual risk. Don and I could simply make a bet on what's going to happen with the mortgage obligations or the loans that Lisa has made. If she's going to have a default, then I can bet that I want to gain on that because I want to take the risk that that may happen. Don, on the other hand, may think that that's not going to happen, so he would take the other side of that contract with me. So the question is, why aren't these regulated? And of course, that's been an issue that's been going on for years. Historically, up until about 1990, the only derivative contract that could be traded by individuals and most institutions had to be done so on a centralized exchange, a futures exchange, that was regulated by the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Then starting in the early 90s, a lot of these more complex, esoteric swap transactions started to get more and more play amongst institutional and sophisticated investors. Without going into the legal specifics of it, they tried to carve out an exemption from the commodities laws that basically allowed these over-the-counter derivatives, namely those not traded on an exchange, to be traded without any regulation. Then in 2000, Congress passed the Commodities Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which, among other things, had the effect of blessing that approach to the over-the-counter derivatives market, namely not regulating over-the-counter derivatives, which includes credit derivative swaps that we've talked so much about, you've read so much in the news. So the question becomes, what type of regulation do we have if this derivative contract that I described were done as an insurance contract? Then the person giving me the insurance would be regulated under the law of some state, because insurance laws have state-based regulation, and Don's going to talk a little bit more about that. If we do it as a securitized loan, a securitized product, sort of a CDO, then the SEC might have some jurisdiction because securities are regulated by the SEC. But if we do the transaction as a swap, as a derivative contract, as sort of a bet or a hedge between two counterparties, then currently there is no regulation whatsoever. In terms of what's likely to be happening in the future, you see Chairman Cox of the SEC saying we should regulate CDSs, credit derivative swaps. The state of New York has announced that starting January 1st, it's going to regulate at least a large portion of the credit derivative market, credit derivative swaps, saying that however you describe them, you can call them a swap, you can call them a derivative, but it's really an insurance contract. So there's going to clearly be some sort of a jurisdictional battle now. The Treasury Department, there have been some thoughts about the Treasury Department now being the super regulator that's going to regulate everything. And I'll let others talk about the wisdom of some of these approaches. Basically, at this point, I will stop, and certainly, are there any questions about the regulatory, the banking aspects? We will take them up later as part of the question and answer.
I'm Don Hornstein. I'm a law professor, and I teach insurance law, and I'll talk about insurance, but I also teach the law of regulatory systems. And when we look at government and we want to know, like, how is it doing? How are we doing? How is it doing for us? And I thought I'd address that last issue first, because it hasn't been talked about. And it's, I don't know about you, but it is shocking to me to realize that it is not even 3 weeks, it's not even until 3 weeks tomorrow that this bailout bill has been passed. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm like so totally sick of hearing about it. But I also feel like it's been with us for more like 30 years. I just can't believe it's not even 3 weeks. It's not even a month since the first bailout bill, the one that was voted down, was even introduced. And I thought in the context of these, just those two things that the government has done, we might try to get a sense of, is it even remotely approaching solutions to the problems that the economists and the business people have been illustrating to us? I mean, how are we to think about it? And I think I'll do it in the context of two metaphors that I hear constantly in the news. The first is a medical metaphor. The economy is sick. And so how can we judge it in terms of how you deal with a sick person? And the second is I keep hearing these weather metaphors. It's either a perfect storm of all these things coming together. This morning, Alan Greenspan referred to it as a credit tsunami that has broken upon us. So, and I think it's useful to think about those weather metaphors because, frankly, one of the things I teach when I'm not teaching insurance is environmental law, and I am struck when I teach environmental law, and especially when I talk about climate systems and these emerging carbon solutions, that people also talk about weather as a complex system, and how are we to design governmental programs to deal with any complex system. So I want to address how the government is doing in those two ways. Think of it first in the medical metaphor, a sick person. It's sort of simple when you look at how the medical profession addresses a sick person who, say, comes to the hospital. There's sort of a standard three-prong approach. The first is some immediate triage. You have to stabilize the patient. The patient must not die. Everybody agrees with that. But after you stabilize the patient, you haven't even begun to cure, and you have to go to step two, which is then you figure out what's wrong with the patient, and you begin trying to cure. You're going to do surgery, you're going to do chemo, you're going to do something. But other than just keep them alive, you have to cure it, the patient. And then, lastly, there's some sort of rehabilitation, where you get it back up, and it's out of the hospital and out where it's supposed to be. I think it's fair to say that at this point, everything the government has done has been at step one. It's trying to make sure the economy doesn't die. And it's trying to, and the interesting thing that has struck me just for the last month is how it keeps lurching, trying to figure out, well, let's take this emergency measure. Let's put a tourniquet on. They go, well, no, he's not bleeding to death. It's something else. And then they try something else. And the thing that I do want to mention that's just interesting and doesn't get much play is, despite the confusion, how the government seems, at least in this first stage, to have actually moved in this barely this month to a fairly hopeful approach, at least to maybe stabilizing the problem. It was a month ago that the Bush administration and Henry Paulson actually stood in front of us and said, we want $700 billion, and here is the legislation. This was the original bailout bill. I have the legislation. First of all, $700 billion wasn't that long ago when that was the entire budget of the United States. And when it was the entire budget of the United States, the budget document that accompanied it was like this thick. Well, here's a request for $700 billion 1 month ago that was introduced. This is the entirety of it. It's 2 pages. I actually got an extra page. What is it? 2 pages long. And we were told, Paulson said, well, you simply must. If you don't authorize this, we will die. And then Ben Bernanke said the same thing, we will die. And then Bush got on TV and said, you will authorize this or we will die. There was a newspaper out of University of Wisconsin called The Onion. And it had, I love The Onion. And it had a headline in The Onion, it's like a fake newspaper. And the headline was, Bush calls for panic. And that seemed to be their strategy. I mean, it seemed to be, you must panic and pass this bill. And you all remember, by the way, we didn't. People were so furious that they said, you know, we'd rather die than give you, with no strings attached, $700 billion. Plus, there's no heads rolling. And there's an element of fairness rather than just living that is important to us. That was actually hopeful. The government then came back within a week with a 410-page bill, the so-called TARP bill, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP. And the interesting thing about it is you may and that was the $700 billion, and that was passed, and that got that has all the political play that we're hearing in the news now, that second bill. The one point I want to make about that is, do you remember when it was passed, apart from just the residual anger that not enough people are going to jail and so on under this, when people looked at it, people were concerned that the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which proposed to buy what were called troubled assets, no one was really sure at the triage level that this would actually solve the problem. I mean, what about these assets? Are you really sure if you spend $700 billion, you'll keep the patient alive? I mean, the worst case scenario is we spend $700 billion, but like Tom says, we have a $300 trillion credit default system market we don't even understand, in which case you're just throwing a stone into the ocean and we sink, and it would be awful. And what the plan was, no, don't worry, we will buy these troubled assets. And they were these, for the most part, these securitized, the most vulnerable securitized loans. And it was passed. And if you read the subtext the day after it passed, there was a lot of questions among economists. How exactly are you going to buy them? There were these reverse auctions that no one had any confidence in because of this market for lemons problem. No one knew what to do. And then the interesting thing is that it was passed on a Friday, October 3rd. The stock market dropped 500 points. Then there was a weekend of utter panic. And then Monday, the stock market dropped 400 points. Tuesday, the stock market dropped 500 points. And people thought, oh my God, you know, we're putting a tourniquet on a problem. And that's not the problem. That's what the market's telling us. We're dying, and they don't know what it is. Wednesday, Paulson stands up and says, well, we're going to buy the banks. And I wondered, Well, where did you get, I mean, it's good, we probably, and it seems, the market seems to say that stabilized somewhat the immediate problem, but I wondered, how could you even do that legally? They're not, I mean, buying the banks is different than buying these troubled assets. And I was curious how you could use $250 billion from the $700 billion bailout for that. That didn't seem to be what it was for. The interesting thing is, minutes before it was passed by the House, the definition of troubled assets was changed to mean troubled assets or any other financial instrument. And Barney Frank and a guy named Moran, a representative from Virginia, got on the floor and had a little colloquy for 30 seconds and said, just so we're clear, this change means you can actually use this $700 billion to buy anything, any financial product. And Barney Frank says, that's right. Because they knew that this, we might need to do that, but that would run into all kinds of flack by people who couldn't imagine you'd be socializing the banks. So they snuck it in, and then, frankly, Paulson just grabbed it. It was a life raft, and after England used the same thing, and it seemed to work overseas, we did, and we began to stabilize. It's just an interesting thing that, in fact, we sort of groped our way toward a good solution. Let me make one. And the real issue, of course, is after we're done figuring out the triage and we stabilize the patient, how we actually figure out what the problem was and move into the cure. And there's a lot of issues on that, and there's a lot of issues, too, as to what sort of regulatory mechanism we're going to use and who is going to do it. I will mention just this one point, because we're still not sure what the underlying cause was, and so I'll come back to that weather metaphor. You know, if it was a perfect storm, it was a perfect storm of what? What were these forces that culminated in this horrible thing? And then we have to get to the underlying forces. There was one thought that Tom mentioned that I'll just pick up on because I also teach insurance law. It had to do with these credit default swaps. I mean, the history of finance, and I'm not a financial historian, really over a couple hundred years, is one innovation after another. And these innovations have very good sides to us. Don't kid ourselves. On the good times, we care about these innovations. But the interesting thing about the securitization of mortgages and the credit default swaps that let people make side bets to insure them is that they were new. The market for these credit derivatives in 2000 was about $1 trillion. By 2007, when the stuff was hitting the fan, the market, has, as Tom suggested, might have been $70 trillion. I mean, to put that in perspective, the GDP of the US every year is $16 trillion. I mean, the real economy. What is this? And if, in fact, this thing that has never been out before now meets the perfect storm of the foundation on which it's based, these mortgages, is crumbling, you know, what's going to happen? One thought is we regulate these as insurance. I will say this. We actually tried this once before. When Lloyd's of London was first formed as insurance, the people at Lloyd's Coffee Shop would sit and actually make bets, not just on their own lives, but like on the life of the king. And you'd say, well, I think the king is going to die this year. And you take out a life insurance policy on his life, and so would 1,000 other people. They put an end to that for obvious reasons. But the biggest secondary reason was, apart from the fact that there was the moral hazard that someone would kill the king, the concern was it's just gambling, because you are actually putting a bet on something in which you have no underlying interest. And that might, in fact, account for a lot of these credit default swaps, as Tom said, the so-called naked ones. We don't know how these will work. I don't think they should be regulated as insurance. Insurance, as Tom says, is state by state. It's too balkanized, too local. They'll have to be regulated at Washington as a financial instrument by some of these fancy organizations, but they'll need to be regulated one way or the other to move into the second phase and start addressing these problems.
Well, I'm Richard Froyen, professor of economics here at UNC. And so what I'm going to talk about is the Federal Reserve's response to the current crisis. The current crisis is often compared to the situation in the United States during the Great Depression. And so to start, I might look at some comments that business leaders expressed when they had hearings in 1932 during the Great Depression, and they asked them what the problem was. So the CEO of Montgomery Ward is quoted as saying, "To describe the causes of this situation is rather beyond my capacity. I'm unfortunate in having no friends that seem able to clearly explain it to me." Myron Taylor, who was at the time president of U.S. Steel, stated that out of this depression we are going through, we shall have learned something of high importance. He then said, "It's too soon to know what that will be." Now, some thought they had solutions to the problem. Bernard Baruch, who was the advisor to many U.S. presidents and was a sage, at least as his press agent said, he said the solution was balance budgets, stop spending money we haven't got, sacrifice for frugality and revenue, cut government spending, cut it as rations are cut in a siege, tax everybody for everything. Now, this was a prescription for disaster. But Myron Taylor was right, and we did learn something of importance out of that. And what we learned was expressed by Franco Modigliani, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, as the central practical message of John Maynard Keynes' general theory, which was that a private enterprise economy using an intangible money, and today I would substitute having a highly specialized financial sector, needs to be, can be, and therefore should be stabilized by appropriate monetary and fiscal policies. Now, Ben Bernanke, as an academic economist, was a very careful student of the Great Depression. And in general, not just a student of the Depression as a whole, but of the role of credit and of the banking system in the Depression, and more generally, the role of the importance of credit in the transmission of monetary policy and in macroeconomics as a whole. And the application of Keynes's message to the current financial crisis, and it's not exclusively Keynesian, this isn't really a controversial point about schools of macroeconomics, but the general message there is that the Federal Reserve or central bank is the only agent in the economy that has the will and the ability to expand its own balance sheet, create liabilities on itself, which are assets to the financial institutions and other institutions that enable them to provide credit to the economy. And they're the only institution that can really prevent massive amounts of failure of financial institutions. So that's the lesson that we learned from the Depression, and that Bernanke in particular has definitely taken in. So what did the Fed do? And I want to talk only about the Federal Reserve response to the crisis, and just because that's my what I have time for, and it'd be a different kind of a verdict perhaps if we talked about their role in the inception of the crisis, and then a completely different topic as to what will be their role in getting to the cure of this crisis. But let me just give you a few steps. Beginning in September of 2007, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee began to lower the target federal funds rate. During the period since then, it's gone from 5.25% down to 1.5%. The Fed began the loan auction program in December of 2007 when it became clear that banks were reluctant to lend freely to each other. That program's been expanded several times. In January of 2008, they set up a term facility to make funds available to banks for periods longer than overnight. This program's been expanded also several times. The Fed opened the discount window to primary dealers in government securities, basically investment banks, in March after the failure of Bear Stearns. When lending to these financial institutions didn't result in adequate freeing up of credit markets, earlier this month they started to lend directly to corporations, so to bypass the banks that just sit on the funds that they get and lend directly to the corporations. And last Monday, they began an initiative that will lend to the issuers of money market funds who are hesitant to, in their turn, lend to financial institutions because they're afraid they won't be able to keep the value of their funds at a dollar to a dollar. So the Fed has said, if you need money, come to us, give us that commercial paper you have or those bank CDs you have, and we'll give you cash. So these initiatives have increased total borrowing from the Federal Reserve by over $500 billion in the past year. And if you look at the expansion of loan facilities, it's been even greater. The money market initiative alone is $500 billion. So the Federal Reserve has responded in large numbers, larger than the numbers we're talking about for allocations of money by Congress. And they've been broad in scope and imaginative in the ways that they go about this. So why do we still have a crisis? If we get to this medical analogy, we could say, well, the patient could say, well, you know, Dr. Bernanke, you're a very smart guy and you're giving me a lot of medicine, but I'm still awfully sick. You know, what's going on here? Well, I think the Federal Reserve has to date been constrained in three ways. First, a solution to the overall crisis requires measures that are beyond the sphere of what central banks can legitimately do. The Fed's been operating on the boundary of that sphere, using a provision in a Depression-era statute that allows them to lend in cases of financial exigency to any corporation, partnership, or individual. So they're operating at the boundary, and back in the spring, even Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker were telling Ben Bernanke that you're at the edge of what a central bank should do. If you're going to recapitalize the banking sector, or if you're going to buy up massive amounts of these troubled assets, then you're putting large amounts of taxpayer money at stake, and the taxpayers deserve to have their representatives involved in that decision. So it was necessary to bring Congress, albeit kicking and screaming, into this process. Choosing which institutions to let fail, whether to bail out AIG, bail out have Bear Stearns incorporated by J.P. Morgan, or let Lehman Brothers fail, those are decisions that the Fed feels very uncomfortable making. So it wasn't surprising that in the weekend after the weekend in September, when Lehman Brothers went down and AIG was lent $85 billion, that Bernanke asked Paulson to go to Congress, and Congress didn't want them there. They didn't want to be asked to make a vote on this before the election, but they went there and told them the patient was dying. The patient was in bad shape. So this process has begun. Secondly, other central banks really need to be part of the process before you get to a solution of what's really a global financial crisis. As the Fed lowered interest rates over the course of the first half of 2007, the European central banks didn't. European central banks were very helpful in the crisis in terms of putting a lot of liquidity into the financial markets, but they didn't lower interest rates. The result of that was that the spread between the European rates and the US rates was really pushing the dollar down. And by the time he gave his speech at Harvard in June, Bernanke expressed the worry of the Fed that there could be a dollar crisis. Now the other central banks are more on board, both in terms of the last cut in October 15th, of a half point in the funds rate was also a cut made by the Swedish central bank, the Swiss central bank, the Bank of England, the ECB, and so a unified cut. The third constraint was until recently, commodity prices were rising rapidly. The oil price had hit $145. That's a big constraint on the Fed. They want to encourage the economy to grow, but they worry about inflation. The last time they were accused of being behind the curve was in the 70s when inflation got out of hand, and they don't want to see that happen again. Now commodity prices are coming down, oil most dramatically, but other commodity prices as well, so they're freed of that constraint. So what can we expect? What I think is that we learned a lot. Myron Taylor was right. We learned a big lesson from the Depression. The Fed, on its own, will prevent that. They have the tools to prevent a financial meltdown that would lead to something like the Great Depression. Second question, can they prevent something like Japan in the 90s, where there was a decade with three recessions and deflation? The answer to that, I think, is also yes. Though there, it's more important that they get cooperation from other central banks. Then, finally, can they prevent a serious recession in the United States? Alone, no. There, they would need cooperation from the fiscal authorities, and as Stanley may get to, other kinds of policies that are beyond the sphere of what the Federal Reserve can do. So if I looked at the response, I'd say the Federal Reserve has been imaginative and has really done well, but there are limitations to what the central bank can do. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Stanley Black from the Economics Department, and I'm going to cover some similar aspects to what has been discussed before, but also try to lead us in a direction that may find a way to revive our financial markets. Now, let me start off by, I'm going the wrong way here. The problem that we're looking at was actually foreseen. And it's a shocking thing to think that it was well known to some really important people. Ned Gramlich, who is was the late Ned Gramlich, was a governor of the Federal Reserve Board and actually a friend of mine and former classmate. He had been warning Alan Greenspan since 2002 that the subprime crisis was going to blow up. He published a book just before he died in the middle of 2007, which I recommend to everybody. Nouriel Roubini, an economist at NYU, who produces something called the RGE Global Monitor, you can find it on your web, has been predicting this for several years. So this is not a surprise, really. Maybe the magnitude is a surprise, but the fact that it was happening is not a surprise. Alan Greenspan knew about these warnings, and he ignored them. So did the government. And so, really, they deserve a good share of blame for this. Now, the subprime mortgages were, many of them, set up with adjustable rate mortgages. And as we know, the low interest rates of the early 2000s soared in 2006, and that jacked up the payments for many of these people who could not afford them. And the housing market came to the end of its boom, and housing prices started falling, as was indicated earlier. And, as it was pointed out earlier, 20% of the mortgages that were made in the year 2006 were subprimes, up from only 5% 10 years earlier. And as I understand, 40% of all the mortgages that were made in 2006 were actually for either second homes or for speculative purchases. So this was a speculative boom that was really out of control. As a result, we've got lots of homeowners whose house prices are now lower than the value of the mortgage that they've got. And so there is a real serious problem with foreclosures. Now, as was pointed out about the mortgage-backed securities, they were rated highly by the rating agencies when they were divided up into these tranches and when they were over-collateralized and when credit default swaps were written appearing to insure against the risk that they might default. But the defaults are happening now, up to the rate of 300,000 in the month of August, according to the data that I've seen. And there are up to 1 million foreclosed properties in the United States for sale right now. So this is, the housing market is in crisis. The housing market crisis has spilled over onto the financial sector because it was riding these securities, and they are coming back to bite it. So Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two largest creators of mortgages in the country, were nationalized effectively by the government without compensation to the previous owners, by the way, and Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail. And these things have thrown a huge shock through the financial system. As a result, credit markets have frozen up, and the spread between LIBOR, which was explained as the rate that banks use to lend to each other, and the Treasury bill rate, which is the safe rate, went up to 4.5 percentage points. That was an extra insurance premium the banks were charging each other for a loan because they were afraid that the other bank might not be around. Now that has fortunately come back down to where it's only 2.5 percentage points, 250 basis points for the experts. But it's still way above the normal 1% level. So what has been happening to the real economy? That's what we haven't heard so much about up to now, and my job is partly to tell you a little bit about the real economy side of it. So we know the housing market has been in decline since 2006, but that's spilling over onto the rest of the economy. For the entire year 2008 so far, purchase of consumer durables, such as automobiles, refrigerators, and so forth, things, furniture that go into houses and or require credit for purchases, that's been falling for the whole year of 2008 so far. Business investment has been declining, and industrial production is declining. Employment has been declining throughout the year 2008. So we are in a recession. And the question really is, how long and how deep is this recession going to be? And I think the outlook is not particularly good. The unemployment has been rising since 2007. And, of course, this is having its effect throughout the economy. This is broad-based. This is not confined just to the housing sector. Banks are failing not only in the United States, where we've had Washington Mutual, Indy Bank out in the Indy Mac Bank, I think it was called, out in California, and but also in Europe and Iceland. They had some banks that had very expansive businesses that have failed and had to be nationalized. So we really have, this is a global problem. The stock market crash is not just happening in the United States, it's happening globally. If you look at the decline in stock market prices in Latin America, in Asia, in Europe, in the United States over the past year, they're all down 30 to 40%. So this is a major and unfortunate event. So my view about the recession, Richard was saying what he thinks it's going to look like, I think it's going to be like 1981-82, up to 10% unemployment, which will last for a year or so. That's my outlook. That's my hopeful outlook. That's what I hope it will be no worse than that. But given we've had this kind of trouble, what do we need to do to restore our credit markets? And it seems to me the problem here is that we have lost trust in our financial markets. Not only we have lost trust, but the whole world has lost trust in our financial markets. And financial markets have to exist on trust, the basis of trust. After all, what they sell is pieces of paper, right? And these pieces of paper are no better than the promises of the people who promise to pay you back. So we need, and they have violated those promises by selling us bad paper. So our financial markets are in trouble. What we've got to do is figure out a way to get that trust back. Now, I've been thinking about a little example of, suppose I loaned my brother-in-law, he's long deceased, so I'm not going to insult anybody in particular here. Suppose I loaned my brother-in-law $10,000 to pay back a medical bill that his wife, my sister, had incurred for something, serious problem. And suppose I found out that he took that $10,000 and went out and lost it in a poker game or at the racetrack or somewhere like that. I would lose trust in him as a reliable character. How could he earn my trust back? Well, he might do it by saving up the money, first of all, to pay back the debt up to the hospital, and second, to pay me back. So you have to earn it back by responsibility, responsible behavior. And it seems to me that regulations are going to have to be set up to enforce responsibility and accountability in our financial markets, since they have not proven capable of doing it on their own, as Alan Greenspan realized at long last today. So I have two suggestions. One is that mortgage makers should be required to retain a share of the mortgages that they may want to sell part of it on later. That was suggested earlier, I believe, by somebody on the panel. And secondly, I think the credit default swaps writers, the people who write these insurance policies on the loans, the mortgage-backed securities and other kinds of loans, they should be required, like other insurers, to hold reserves. As it has been, all they've had to do is write the insurance on these loans and collect the premiums, the revenues. It's as if you were an insurance company that were writing flood insurance on houses along the Gulf Coast from Texas to Mississippi, and we're just not going to worry about the possibility that a hurricane might come up. You're just going to hope the sun keeps shining, in other words. They should be required to hold reserves if they're going to write that kind of insurance. And secondly, the buyers of this insurance should be required to hold the underlying security that's being insured. You shouldn't be able to buy a gamble on the idea that Ford Motor is going to go default on its securities unless you own those securities, because otherwise it's just a casino. And I think that's going to... So these are my proposals, and I'm sure we'll hear more ideas as we go into further discussion of this.
Okay. Well, I haven't been very good at keeping time. No match for these guys. But I just wanted to introduce Gene Flood, the star of the evening, if you will. This is a man who does it. He lives it every day. He's president and CEO of Smith, Breeden & Associates. Gene, thank you.
Good evening, everyone. You've heard a lot of material already tonight, and I want to make sure that we have some time for questions. So I'm going to cut down my comments some, and then we can talk some more during the Q&A part. I run an investment management firm. We trade all of these things that you've been hearing about tonight. Subprime mortgages, agency mortgages, corporate bonds, CDS, every single thing that you've heard talk about tonight is what we trade. We manage the accounts on behalf of institutions. So our clients are central banks around the world, insurance companies, pension funds, endowments, all of the people who are investing in these markets. I've been with this firm for 7 years. Before that, I spent about half my career on Wall Street with Morgan Stanley, trading these same things. And then before that, I was on the faculty at the Stanford Business School teaching about, most of these things weren't invented then. So a lot of this is new. And I've been in the fray helping to create these things and then valuing them and using them every day. So it's been a very exciting period over the last 18 months. It's just been actually, exciting is probably not the right word. I would just say, I'd say chaotic. I mean, it really has been different than anything that we've lived through before. So having gone through the crash of 87 and traded that as in proprietary trading at Morgan Stanley or through Russia default or the long-term capital management collapse or any of those things are kind of been like a play date compared to what we've been going through recently. We have a framework that we use that as we think about this. And we break up the issues that we're dealing with these days into three categories. First is what's driving things, fear and lack of confidence. That's one area. Second area of what's been pushing this market around is the whole deleveraging. And you've probably heard that term in the newspapers or by commentators on TV. You may have heard me talking about it on CNBC. But I'll explain what that is, the deleveraging, and why it's important. And then the third thing is the economic cycle. So I just want to make a few comments about each one of those areas. What's causing that issue to be so important, how it gets reflected in prices, and then just a couple of comments about the various policy initiatives and to what extent are they helping. And then I'm going to sit down and we'll all field questions together. Let's just start off with the fear and the lack of confidence. What started that? We heard about counterparty risk. And it really, think of it this way. It's if you're a bank and you're trying to decide how much to charge on a loan when you're lending money to somebody else, say another bank, if you don't know what that bank holds on its balance sheet, so what do they hold? What kinds of securities? They hold all these different types of securities. Well, how risky are those securities? How much of them do they hold? And where do they have them marked? Have they marked them all the way down to where they should be? Or are they way too high and they still have to drop those prices and then might not be able to pay you back? Right? That's the counterparty risk issue and the lack of transparency. And so with that, what happened was, like at the beginning of last spring, when that started happening, banks stopped lending to each other. And then companies that needed cash said, oh, well, I need to go to the bank to borrow it. I can't do that because the banks aren't lending. I better sit on all the cash that I can collect. And so all the credit markets just started to close down because of that. Now, the way that showed up in prices was this term LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate, the rate that banks lend to each other. Typically, that's pretty close to a risk-free rate. Pretty close, not exactly, but pretty close. What happened was those rates just started going up, 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 up. And they went up, so they were up at around 4%, over 4%, almost 5%. And Treasury rates were very low. You know, Treasury rates right now, federal fund rates, are 1.5%. Now, the government has been trying to get those markets working again, and so they've been pouring water in there. And we heard about the FDIC and how they have been guaranteeing bank deposits, so deposits, savings deposits that you or I would put in the bank. They've been guaranteeing bank debt. They've been doing everything that they can, both here and then their counterparts in Europe, to try to get lending going again. We've also heard about the commercial paper market, and one of the speakers spoke about that. That is short-term lending that people do with corporations. And that market has also started working a little bit. So the LIBOR rate has come down about 1%, so we've gotten some movement there. Commercial paper market has also started. So this is short-term lending to companies. If you went back 3 weeks ago, the longest most people would do that lending for is, guess how long? Does anybody know? How long? Overnight, right? That would be almost the longest that you could get people to lend to corporations on a short-term basis, just overnight. A little bit, sometimes out to a week. Well, now we're starting to get some movement again, and we're getting movement out to about 1 month. We're still well short of the 3 months and sometimes even out to 9 months that we used to have, but at least now we've got lending that will go out 1 month, so we're getting a little bit of movement there. The other thing that has happened is there's discussion about this credit default swap market, that where companies that we've heard so much about this evening, where institutions primarily are kind of, some are hedging, some are just making uncovered bets about different things that will happen. What's going to happen to the housing sector? What's going to happen to Lehman Brothers? What's going to happen to AIG and so forth? That market really started to have lots of difficulty as well, because what happens is that unlike the stock market, if you go and you buy stocks and you work with an exchange, if my company wants to take a position on what's going to happen to, let's say, General Motors, we can make a bet with another company, let's say PIMCO. You know, Smith Breeden makes a bet with PIMCO saying, I think General Motors is going to run into problems. And PIMCO says, I don't. And so we'll write a contract with each other where the value of it goes up and down with General Motors stock or with General Motors bonds. Right? But now I've got PIMCO's credit risk and they have mine. And if they can't see enough about what's going on my balance sheet, then they're taking my credit risk and they get worried. And if that's happening with lots of us at the same time, then we all just step away and we say, no, we don't want to bet, and everything starts to shut down. So in order to get around that now, there's discussions about putting an exchange in between so that PIMCO would sit on the other side of the exchange and I'll sit on this side, and then I can still make that bet with PIMCO, but every day I have to settle up money. If I gain some, then PIMCO has to pay the exchange, and the exchange will pay me, or if it goes the other way, I do that. And that way, we keep the amounts of the bets relatively small, and if PIMCO defaults, I've still got the exchange in between us, and so that provides a lot of safety. So we've got some movement there, and we don't have that exchange yet, but we're talking about building such an exchange. So where are we on that fear in lack of confidence? I'd say that the market is still about 75% frozen. It's still very hard to borrow money. It's still very hard to do most of the transactions that we would like to do. The second topic, let me cover that a little bit more quickly, deleveraging. What's going on there? What happened is that it all started with housing prices going down. And the housing market started to get soft in the middle of last year, spring of last year. Then all these bonds that Chris was talking about that are based off of houses, the prices on those bonds started going down. Now, think if you're a bank and you've got these bonds on your balance sheet have gone down, and you have to have capital to go to support these positions. If the prices of those go down, then the value of your balance sheet is shrinking, and you've got to do something about that. So you have to sell some securities to get cash back to support your balance sheet. Or if you're a firm like my firm, where we say we might borrow and then buy these securities, if the price goes down, then we have to put up more cash. That is, we have to meet margin to that's being supported by the value of these bonds. Now, how are we going to do that? Well, we have to sell something else. And so you can see that you got banks doing this, you got broker-dealers doing this, you got investment managers doing this, so the prices go down, we have to raise cash, we have to sell something else, the prices go down some more, we have to raise more cash, we sell some more, and then all the prices of things that may not even be related to the housing market are going down because we have to sell whatever we can in order to meet margin. And so you've got prices across the market falling, all started by this problem in the housing market. Now prices are falling for things that are unrelated to houses. And so you've got this, that's why it's called, we had used leverage to get in these positions, now we've got to de-lever to get out of them, okay? And that's what this deleveraging phenomenon is about. Now, what happens to prices when that goes on? Take, for example, commercial mortgage backs, okay? They're not based off of the residential market. They're based off of corporate buildings, right? A lot of those, the U.S. corporate sector is in good shape. So if you look at the loans on those, there's no defaults. There's no delinquencies on lots of them. But the interest rates on those went from about 0.33% above safe interest rates to 6% over. Never seen anything like it, right? These are prices on these bonds were at 100, they fell to 70. But no risk, basically the risks hadn't changed. But they're being pushed by this deleveraging impact. And you see that going on across the marketplace. Now, how much have they come back? We've seen lots of these programs, right? 13 different programs that the Treasury, the FDIC, and the Fed have come out with over the last year and a half. The TARP and all these other things that we've heard about today. Those prices on commercial mortgage-backed securities, the spreads blew out from 0.33% to 6% over safe assets. They've come back to about 5.5%. Okay? So these prices are still under extreme duress. And so I would say, how far along are we on the deleveraging? We don't really know, because this cycle can keep going. There's no logical end to it. I mean, we can't point to anything and say, well, once that happens, no one else will need to deleverage, unless no one's holding anything with leverage. But that's not going to happen. But how long it's going to take, we just don't know. So we're not sure how far along we are on that. And then the last piece here is the economic slowdown, and I'll just stop with that. With the economic slowdown now, that all of these things have happened where raising debt has become much more expensive, these interest rates have gone up by so much, by the lack of credit availability, so my company needs to go and get borrow money to do a transaction. Banks aren't lending. You know, all of those things mean that companies are laying people off. They are investing in less equipment. They are selling assets that they had hoped to hold on to. So the real economy, because of all of those things, is slowing down. And we've heard, you know, different predictions about how dire that's going to be. We certainly think, my company certainly believes that we are going to have a recession. And it's going to be maybe not as bad as 80-81, but it's going to be worse than the 1990 recession and the 2001 recessions. Certainly going to be worse than that. How do we get out of those? What do we do? Well, we need some stimulus to go directly to the heart of the issue, which is the housing issue. So we need some kinds of capital infusion there, some incentives for people who are renters to buy homes. We're going to need some things to stimulate the economy directly, some more fiscal stimulus. You know, we had the package last year, the $150 billion. You know, maybe we need another $150 or $300 billion more to help to keep us from going into a very deep recession. Now, people look at those numbers and they say, wow, those numbers sound pretty big. But just remember, the U.S. economy is really quite large. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to avoid the cost of having very high unemployment rates. So if the economy goes and it slows down by, say, in minus 2%, minus 3%, something like that, on a $12, $13, $14 trillion economy, that adds up very quickly. So if you could avoid some of that by spending $100 billion or $150 billion, it's definitely worth it. I mean, that's the trade-off that we're making as we look at the economy. Now, when you look at what's happened to security prices, and this is where I'll stop, what's happened to security prices now that the real economy has started to slow? Now you've got falling stock market, you've got emerging market debt spreads blowing out, you've got investment-grade corporate spreads blowing out, you've got high-yield spreads going out, you've got leveraged loan spreads going out. So pretty much everything now is getting hit. And so that's where, you know, we need the policies that affect the real economy, this fiscal stimulus, for example. Those are the ways, that's what's going to deal with all of these other asset prices that are now getting hit, that go well beyond where it all started, which was the housing market. So Where are we on that? We're just at the beginning, right? The last print that we got on GDP was 2.2%, right? The next one that we get might be minus one. You know, the one after that might be minus two. So it's, we're at the beginning of that cycle now. So that's the next piece that that we're going to be working our way through. So, you know, as I said at the beginning, I feel like this has, you know, the Russian default and long-term capital management and the crash of 87, that was kind of like a play date compared to what we've been going through so far and what we've still got to work through. So let me stop here. I think we're going to get the speakers all up on the platform here, and then we'll field questions. And